Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I want to tell you a story from way back. Truck on down and dig me, Jack. There's Big Mo. Little Mo. Four-eyed Mo. No Mo. Look at brother. Look at brother. Look at brother. Eat Mo. Who's the greatest band around? Makes the cats jump up and down. Who's the talk of Rhythm Town? Five guys named Mo. When they start to beat it out, everybody jump and shout. Tell me, who do the critics rave about? Five guys named Mo. They came out of nowhere, and that don't mean a thing. They're rate high, and you'll know why when you hear them swing. Highbrow, lowbrow, all agree, they're the best in harmony. I'm telling you, folks, you really ought to see Five Guys Named Mo.
That's Louis Jordan, Louis Jordan, and the Timpani Five, hugely underrated. That was out during the war, 1943 on Decca. Got to number three on the R&B charts. And his five pieces could rival any big band. In fact, some people said he led directly to the demise of needing more than that. But he was a comedian and an actor, and like I say, horribly underrated. People today don't even know who he is. He's the fifth highest R&B chart maker of all time, actually. And that's Five Guys Named Mo. I'm Raleigh James. I'm in for G. And this, of course, is Memorial Day. And we are talking around that topic in a variety of ways. And did you know there's a military library in Chicago? Well, hopefully you're a member as far as that goes. But WGN, by the way, practices physical distancing. I'm in Arizona. And we have in Sierra Vista an amazing military intelligence museum and library at Fort Huachuca. And going there is literally spellbinding. And I would assume, I wouldn't doubt for a moment, that that is the same effect you would have at the Pritzker Military Library. So Dr. Rob Havers is CEO of that. Welcome to WGN Radio.
Thank you very much. Good to be on with you this evening.
Yeah, I'm very interested in this. I looked at the mission statement, and it says it's to acquire and maintain an accessible collection of materials and to develop appropriate programs focusing on the citizen soldier and the preservation of democracy. So firstly, what's a citizen soldier?
I think a citizen soldier really is quite a uniquely American concept. It really originates with the Revolutionary War and the idea that civilians can go about their regular lives as civilians, and in time of crisis, they pull on that uniform, serve the country, do what is needed to be done, and then when the crisis is averted, the war is won, they step back into that civilian livelihood. And that is sort of a thread of continuity throughout U.S. history. As I said, beginning with the Revolutionary War, continues to this very day. And we had in recent weeks the activation of some members of our own Illinois National Guard, and they are the modern embodiment of that citizen-soldier concept.
And that makes sense to me regarding the guard and things like that. But I was thinking of the everyday Joe who is a citizen who might have virtually no knowledge, let alone ability, to in fact engage in that role. The other thing I wondered about when I heard preservation of democracy, I realize I'm playing semantics here, but I don't think you mean that in the literal sense, because of course democracy would be mob rule. The thing that keeps our representative democracy safe is that we're a republic. But I often hear people talk about the preservation of democracy. Now, you're not intending for that in the literal sense.
Well, the museum and library was founded by Colonel Jennifer Pritzker in part to find a home for her own massive collection of military books and materials, but also because there was a strong need, as she understood it, to educate the civilian world about what it is the military does and how it does it. There is a great line from Karl von Clausewitz, the great philosopher of war, who talks about the absolute need for the primacy of civilian control of the military. And Colonel Pritzker was certainly struck by the fact that if you expect the civilian government to control the military and understand it, a better understanding of the military itself is something that needs to be undertaken. And the Pritzker Military Museum and Library endeavors through that mission statement and the inaction of it to provide a space where the civilian world can engage with the military and the military with the civilian world. And if you look on our website, there are a whole array of taped programs discussing national security issues, military history issues, often with serving members of the U.S. military and other militaries as well.
It's a great site as far as that goes. I was looking at it earlier today, PritzkerMilitary.org. I agree with you wholeheartedly on the need for civilians to control the military. And, of course, fortunately, I would say, I guess, United States citizens don't understand what that could mean otherwise. But worldwide, and I know you're quite the historian, worldwide, military coups are not only not unknown, they're almost usual in some countries.
Well, that's right. I think they are a good lesson to what happens when the military tries to take control of the country and the government rather than the civilian government controlling the military.
Now, of course, to our knowledge, we haven't even been close to that compared to, say, some of the South American nations where it's almost behavior as usual. But how close have we come in this country, if at all?
That's a very good question. I would probably say not terribly close. Probably the closest, in all honesty, may well have been at the very birth of the Republic, when General George Washington wins the Revolutionary War, establishes a new nation. But the poison chalice, the possibility of him staying on as president in perpetuity on the back of that military reputation and authority, he steps away, but he could have well done that. Whether that's a military dictatorship is hard to say, but we should be very grateful of the sort of high caliber of senior military leaders in this country.
Now, of course, we're a very young country in the States compared to the European nations and nations all over the world. But when you look at Europe, were there also in its past in, say, the UK, Italy, France, were there military takeovers in their histories?
Not well, let me think. You can probably tell from my accent that I am originally from the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, the role of the army in particular has always often played second fiddle to the role of the Navy in terms of the instantiation of military aspiration and global power. And navies are far more difficult to redeploy to take over a government. And the standing army in the United Kingdom has always been quite small by comparison. If you look at France, however, there was a revolution in 1789, and one of the beneficiaries of that revolution was a young Corsican artillery officer, better known as Napoleon Bonaparte, who rode the zeitgeist, if you like, and established himself as emperor on the back of military success and military credibility and military ability. And you can see the sort of influence of the military in different countries in Europe at different time periods. There's been a strong militaristic streak in Prussia, the Germanic state that eventually unites all the German states under the umbrella of Germany, and two world wars not necessarily following consequently, but the militaristic ability and ambitions of a unified Germany certainly play a role in World War One, absolutely, and then secondly in the Second World War.
When we think about military takeovers, they're almost synonymous, if not completely synonymous, with the words military dictatorship. When that occurs, has it ever been anything other than a dictatorship?
I think if you look at the way in which the military is structured, by necessity, there is an obvious hierarchy. Orders are expected to be obeyed. Democracy in the army, in the fashion at which we enact it, every 4 years in November, or more frequently in local elections. That's not really how militaries function, and nor should they. That means they are well adapted and well designed to win in wartime, because that's the role of the military. Not so adept at governing in peacetime, which is why most military dictatorships and military coups usually end in failure.
That's where I was going next. What's the longest, to your knowledge, military dictatorship in a viable fashion that has existed worldwide?
That is a good question. You might reasonably say, I suppose, that the Franco regime of General Franco in Spain, that lasted from the Spanish Civil War until really just past Franco's death, some 40-odd years or so. There may be others. None spring to mind immediately.
I would agree with you. That was the only one I could come up with as well. Now, you did your PhD thesis on reassessing the Japanese POW experience, particularly the Changi, I probably pronounced that wrong, POW camp, 1942-45. I think today most of us think about that POW experience as just a horrific time. In your reassessment, what did you find?
Well, you're right. The thesis was concerned with the experiences of mainly British and Australian, a handful of U.S. personnel at the Changi POW camp in Singapore. The reassessing component really came about because the popular perception, and indeed the generic reality of captivity at the hands of the Japanese in World War II, was unpleasant, to say the least. At Changi, however, the POWs, for a number of reasons, had far more autonomy to influence their captivity in a way that most prisoners of war of the Japanese did not have. And so the notion of broken men, unable to exert any kind of resistance toward their captors, is untrue at the Changi camp. And Changi is in Singapore, and most of the men who were held there were captured during the fall of Singapore in 1942, what Winston Churchill termed the worst disaster in British military history. So there were a lot of different components that went into the experience of POWs there, and really that story at Changi had never been told in any sort of fashion. So that was a sort of substance of what I wrote about.
Did you look at them, obviously, post POW camp many decades later to see how they fared compared to other Japanese prisoners of war?
To a certain extent, the thesis and really the subsequent book was about the experience from the surrender of Singapore until the liberation of that POW camp and the surrender of the Japanese and the return of the British to Singapore. The lives of those men in the post-war period, those who survived, because most of them went on to other areas of Japanese captivity where conditions were not as benign, and even at Changi they worsened appreciably as the war went on. But 3 years as a prisoner of the Japanese and inculcates in you a degree of resilience that was often manifested in later life, and many of these men went on to very successful and very productive post-war civilian lives, and in large part tried to forget their experiences. And I didn't really talk about what they'd gone through, didn't share much about their experiences, often until very late in their lives.
Well, the resilience of the human spirit, that's definitely the shining light of that. Percentage-wise, what would you think? How many perished?
Well, if you look at the Anglo-Australian experience at Changi and then subsequently on the Burma-Thailand Railway, mm-hmm. which was made famous by the movie in the 1950s, The Bridge on the River Kwai, some 10,000 British, Australian, and U.S. prisoners of war died in that endeavor. And that is excluding other U.S. casualties on such as the Bataan Death March and mm-hmm. elsewhere. And the percentages of those who died as opposed to died in captivity at the hands of the Japanese compared to those who were fatalities at the hands of the Germans, quite pronouncedly greater in the Far Eastern theater. Very different war.
Now, you've spent the bulk of your life studying this, so clearly you've got, and I'm not talking just POW camps, but everything that surrounds military and government and things of this nature. As you look at the point that America is in currently, I'm going to get you to dust off your crystal ball. What worries you the most? What gives you the most hope?
Let me say what gives me the most hope. I think we're very fortunate to be living in the United States of America and to be part of a wider alliance of like-minded nations. And I think the demonstrated ability of the U.S. and her allies to rise to the occasion when challenges come is an ever-present looking back through history. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy in the future or indeed in the immediate present, but that is some reassurance on the horizon, if you mean one of the great strategic threats. I think the U.S. in particular is coming off nearly 20 years of fighting smaller wars against insurgent groupings and has, of necessity, somewhat put aside the great power competition type conflict that the U.S. was very prepared to fight and win for 40 plus years after World War II. I think if you look at the way the United States military is refocusing its efforts on great power competition with China, obviously, and even a resurgent Russia, although Russia's capabilities are comparatively reduced compared to the heady days of the USSR and the Cold War. But the mark of any army or any military is its ability to think about what is coming and to focus not on fighting the last war, but the war that may yet occur. And that is part crystal ball, but part a long, hard look at strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats, good old SWOT analysis. Yeah. And the way the U.S.'s military is responding currently to new threats is positive, I think. But vigilance is ever important.
Absolutely. If we had hours, we could talk about the changing landscape of war, especially over the last 20 years, because it's been fascinating. But those are very hopeful words. Dr. Rob Havers, PritzkerMilitary.org. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Please visit us online. And when COVID is passed, come and see us in person.
Absolutely. I'm Raleigh James, in for G, and this is WGN Radio.